Good morning and welcome to the Eastman Financial Report. I'm Dan Eastman, your host, and today is Wednesday, January 10th, 2024. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Eastman Financial Report and also for watching us on WVW-TV. We really appreciate your viewership, and as I always say, we like to be like to consider ourselves a contributor to the great marketplace of ideas, where we share our thoughts and opinions based upon our First Amendment right to freedom of speech. And that's what we do here on WVW-TV, and that's why we're really happy to be able to bring you this program, as well as all of our great programming, because we like to add our thoughts and our opinions to the great marketplace of ideas that helps to develop and maintain a robust culture. So thanks for tuning in. As you know, WVW-TV has been around for quite a long time, since I think 2006, been broadcasting, and we are not a commercial network. We don't sell advertising. We basically thrive off of the kind, generous donations, not only of our viewers, but also our sponsors. And at the end of the day, if you are so inclined to help us continue this effort, this ministry, this information source, then you can go to the WVW-TV Foundation and make a donation, because that really helps defray and defer the costs of this programming. We also like to thank our sponsors, our corporate sponsors, many of whom have been with WVW-TV for a very long time. The sponsor for my program, of course, is Swiss America Trading, which is an American company based out of Arizona. And they make a market in precious metals, tangible precious metals. So if you're interested in actually acquiring precious metals for an inflation hedge or collection or whatever, you would want to find a strong partner in that space. And of course, Swiss America Trading has been around a very long time. This is the business they're in, and this is what they do, and they're experts, and they're very competent players, very trustworthy. They've been doing this in this space a long time with an excellent reputation. So if you're thinking about adding tangible precious metals to your portfolio or collection, you might want to give them a call, 1-800-519-6271, and ask them for some free information. Tell them Dan Eastman from the Eastman Financial Report sent you, and they're happy to send out some information. You can also go to their website, Swiss America Trading, and you can SwissAmericaTrading.com, and you can shop around on the site, see what they have to offer. And if you use the promo code Eastman, which stands for Eastman Financial Report, you'll be able to take advantage of specials as well as see what they have. And they'll be happy to send you free information on how the precious metals sector operates. As you know, precious metals can be purchased tangible, which means you hold them in your hand. You send them Federal Reserve notes or digital American dollars, and they'll send you gold or silver or platinum that you have in your possession and in your control, and you store them away carefully, and then you have them. It's not a speculative version of gold and silver. You can also buy gold and silver in the speculative markets, where you might buy a share in a fund that holds gold, or perhaps it's a speculative futures contract. But in any event, with respect to tangible precious metals, you hold them and control them. And that's what Swiss America does, and does very well. Of course, they offer a great selection of not only bullion minted coins that are minted by the U.S. Mint and other government mints around the world, they also have blocks of bullion in various and sundry sizes. And they also have numismatic coins, which are gold and silver coins issued a long time ago, prior to, I think, 1933. And those are collector coins as well. So if you're interested in exploring that space, or you want to add to your holdings of tangible metals, give Swiss America a call at 1-800-519-6271. Or go to their website, use the promo code Eastman, and see what they have to offer. And keep in mind that precious metals are also an interesting gift. You know, we've just left the gift-giving season behind. But, you know, in spring, the graduations start to come about. And that's something to think about for graduation gifts. You know, what an interesting and perhaps symbolic but also valuable gift to be able to buy somebody and give a gift of precious metals, because it's a subtle reminder that back in the day, America's coins were gold and silver. And up until 1913, when the Federal Reserve was invented, that was the means of exchange. And it might be something to think about for young people graduating, to perhaps have a real piece of money in their sock drawer, in addition to all their wonderful digital money, so that in the event that the, you know, inflation keeps going or whatever, you'll be able to reference back to that point. So it's really a great way to educate as well as to give a gift. So think about that. Give Swiss America a call, 1-800-519-6271. Go to the website, swissamerica.com, and shop around and see if there isn't something of the right size and shape and color just for your gift-giving needs. Okay, let's move into the news today. There's, you know, it's an interesting time, and of course we're now entering the crazy season of the election of 2024, and there are a number of interesting news stories, and there will be. This is going to be a very turbulent period of time from an economic perspective, a financial perspective, and perhaps even a regulatory perspective. But let's talk about first and foremost the relationship between the Federal Reserve System itself and the United States Treasury. And if you let's just do a little history lesson here. We've got plenty of time today. If you think back, if you can remember back, and I doubt any of you are alive who were then alive at that point, but 1913 was a big watershed year under President Woodrow Wilson in the beginnings of the 20th century. That would be contemporary to our 2023. And of course, that was 1913, so that was 110 years ago. But there was a great deal of optimism at the end of the 1800s. And as we approached the new century, it was a century of great optimism and advancing technologies, very simple technologies, but advancing nonetheless. And of course, there was a monetary system that was quite rickety because it was still based very much on private banks and private bank notes that were backed by gold and silver to some extent. We had a convertible dollar, but to gold. There was the great raging battle of the silver people versus the gold people. And here in my part of the continent, in the Midwest, there was a great push to try and bring silver money back into common circulation. And there it was in circulation, but the idea was that that was supposed to be the basis for the economy. And the economy at that time in the early 1900s, late 1800s, was purely expansionary. The railroads were pushing west into the Great Plains and beyond to the West Coast, and businesses were popping up all along these corridors. And we look at American interstate highways, and you see every intersection's got the same, you know, restaurants and businesses. Was the same thing back in the railroad days. If the railroad came through your little town, that was a gold mine, and everybody, the merchants would surround the train depot because it was a transportation node. And all of that development in the late 1800s leading into the 1900s was required cash and money. And the population was growing and businesses were expanding and farmers were farming. And at the end of the day, people needed money. You needed the currency to liquefy the economy. And when money became scarce, the economy would slow down. And that was always a big problem. And banks were lending with these banknotes, and they were overextending themselves because they were effectively lending on the gold and silver in their vaults. And at the end of the day, if you would issue $10 per ounce, and then maybe you did 20 and leveraged it, and then somebody wanted the silver, the banks were collapsing left and right. And we were entering a period of time where the banking system just simply could not handle the expansion of the economy, as it was just expanding with immigrants coming in and pioneers spreading out and settlers following right behind. And at the end of the day, there just frankly, there wasn't enough money in the system, and it would cause these interesting panics. And it was a very nasty panic in 1907 that took a lot of efforts to contain, and it started out in the Midwest areas and the central areas in Ohio and then New York was where all the money was, of course. And J.P. Morgan himself had to actually step in 1907 and effectively save the American banking system from collapse. And he's a private individual. There was no government regulation whatsoever. And people were beginning to realize that a modern economy needed a modern banking system. And there was a lot of pressure because the political the small D Democrats, okay, these were not the Democratic Party of today, which has nothing to do with the Democratic Party of the last two centuries ago. But at the end of the day, the populist parties were realizing that a central bank was not a good thing because it was concentrating power and it was always in New York. That's where the banking was. Washington was at that time, this is before World War I actually, was still sort of a small national government, which is the way it was designed. And we all wish it was that way today. And it's not, it's a monster. But the point is, New York really called the shots. It was where the money and the funding came for the railroads and the industry that followed it, and the steel industry and, you know, the early oil industry. All of the great American expansion of industrial might came from Wall Street financing, primarily J.P. Morgan himself. And at the end of the day, it was kind of a small private club. And these people realized that they needed to have a modern banking system. And it was a great debate going on. We didn't want a national bank. We didn't want the Bank of England. We didn't want any of that stuff. From a populist perspective, we wanted the federal treasury to mint gold and silver coins, and that was the specie that was used as people traded coins. And that's why coins were so very valuable, because a dollar bought something because it was basically, they were scarce. I mean, and that's the big thing about the amount of dollars in a system on a gold and silver basis are by nature limited to the amount of gold and silver you have in the treasury. So if you think about it, if a government, we start over a fresh slate and we say, let's monetize with silver and gold, we would take how much gold there is in Fort Knox and wherever they have it stashed away, and silver, there would be a national stockpile, and they would issue notes like silver certificates or gold certificates based upon the number of ounces of gold and silver that would be in the national stockpile. And that's a finite number. So that's how many dollars are in circulation, either silver dollars, you can have a piece of silver like you can buy from Swiss America. If you want to buy a good old-fashioned 1880s or early 1900s silver dollar, you can give them a call, 1-800-519-6271. They'll be happy to sell you one. And it's really a numismatic treasure because that was a dollar. And of course, there were paper versions of that that were issued by the U.S. Treasury, where if you took, and frankly, I remember this as a kid, you could take that paper dollar, it's a silver certificate on it, to a federal bank or the Federal Reserve in Chicago, if you happen to be on the train heading there, and you'd give them that piece of paper and they'd hand you 10 dimes, because basically 10 dimes equaled one piece of paper that said silver certificate. Well, that all went away, because what happens in a monetary system that you put paper out and the paper is based on the number of ounces of gold and silver is you have a finite money supply. It's fixed. So if you can imagine, there's this $1 million and we spread it around the United States of America and there's 330 million Americans. So each one of us gets, you know, like 13 cents or 12 cents or something. That nickel, that penny, that dime is worth a lot because the money is so scarce that it has value to everybody because it's very competitive. And, you know, and back in the day when I taught, economics in college, and then when I was the state securities commissioner, we would go to the high schools with the stock market game and we'd play these games. And if you give every child in the high school class equal amount of money and then they do the game, it's amazing, but inevitably there are a few kids who accumulate this great big pile, and most of the kids have, like, you know, 2 cents left. It's phenomenal to watch. It's a reflection of the way human nature operates, that in a society with a finite amount of money, there's going to be really rich people who are clever and they can figure out how to get all the money from everybody else. And then there's the folks who didn't quite catch on and they're poor because they didn't quite catch how the game was played. Same thing in a national economy. And that's why sometimes when we talk about hard money, and if, you know, I spent my academic career thinking about Austrian economics, the hard money crowd. When you think about having paper money based upon metal, ounces of metal, it's a finite number. And if you put that into the economy, within 10 to 20 years, there's going to be a lot of rich people and a lot of poor people. And that's what was being reflected back in the late 1800s into the early 1900s. The farmers out in the Midwest were beholden to the railroads to get their crops back to Chicago and then to the East Coast. And of course, those were monopolies, and they charged pretty much what it cost to produce the crop. And there was no money in the system. Money was scarce and hard to come by. So if you had a nickel in your pocket or a silver dime in your pocket, you were well off. And that's because of the money was scarce. And that was a big part of the raging debate with the Grange and other debates. I think Williams Jennings Bryant, you know, don't crucify us on a cross of gold. You know, we want silver money. We don't want gold because gold's controlled by New York and silver is the money of the people and gold is the money of the bankers. And there's always this debate. So within this maelstrom emerges this idea, let's invent the Federal Reserve and have fiat money, and we can print up as much money as we need, and there'll always be money for the farmers, and there'll always be money for the bankers, and everybody will be happy. And that was the political argument. If you go back to the congressional record to look at the debates as to how the Federal Reserve was authorized by Congress and signed into law by President Wilson, there was a lot of give and take. And the idea that sold the day was, look, with a finite monetary system, there's going to be huge winners and vast numbers of losers, just like we have today, because there's no difference between a paper dollar backed by gold coins or ounces and the ounces themselves. So politics being what it is, we ended up with a Federal Reserve system, which was sold on basically two concepts. Number one, we could expand the money supply so the farmers in the Midwest and beyond would have money, and they're screaming for money. They want money. And at the same time, we can preserve the banks with the lender of last resort. So if a bank is failing, the Federal Reserve shovels money in the back door and the bankers are shoveling out the front door to stop the Jimmy Stewart, Mary Poppins bank runs. Okay. And that's how this thing came to be. So it passed in 1913. And of course, so did the income tax. And this was another idea, which was sort of bizarre. And I think the timing, there are a lot of people, you know, the tinfoil hat crowd, probably including me, who think that's sort of a suspicious nexus. But at the end of the day, from 1913 on, the banking system had its Federal Reserve. It was not a government agency. It was set up. All the Federal Reserve banks were owned by local banks, and the local banks are owned by people. There's no government ownership of the Federal Reserve. Now, the compromise, of course, was, well, we're going to have a Federal Reserve Board of Governors, and those seven people will be appointed by the President of the United States for a 15-year term. And of course, if you can do math, you know that presidents can be elected to eight years. Okay, that's the maximum run. But that happened in the 1930s with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt into his fourth term, and everybody got sort of tired of that. Then he died in office. So then they passed a constitutional amendment saying that you can only serve two terms. And then it's not really clear if it's two terms in a row. I mean, you know, or can you run, serve two terms and then take a term off and then run again? We haven't sorted all that out, but you know, something tells me the Supreme Court may have to scratch the dust off of those documents. But at the end of the day, that's how it came to be that in 1913, these people were appointed to very long terms because Roosevelt died shortly before his 16th year in office. And that was the longest serving president. And I think there was this idea that you'd want to have these governors on the Federal Reserve that are friendly to the President of the United States, even though the banking system itself owned the Federal Reserve. And that's one of the reasons the Federal Reserve system is basically 12 regions across the United States, each with their own Federal Reserve Bank and a president thereof and a board of directors. So traditionally, the banking system and the Federal Reserve operated outside of the purview of the federal government, with this exception that the Board of Governors, seven of them, were appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. But when we look at our Federal Open Market Committee, that's not only the seven appointees, it's also the president of the New York Federal Reserve Bank and six other bank presidents out of the remaining 11. And you put that group together, they get together almost monthly and they have great meetings and wonderful lunches. And then they decide what they're going to do with the interest rates, whether they're going to create or the, you know, pull the punch bowl back or push it a little farther forward. So the purpose of this lecture, of course, is to explain that these are separate legal entities. The federal government doesn't run the Federal Reserve, but yet we hear more and more that the interaction with the Federal Treasury, which at this point is Secretary Janet Yellen, who is the former chair of the Federal Reserve. So she's very knowledgeable. She knows how this whole thing works. But the question becomes, is the Federal Reserve independent? Do they make monetary policy to keep money in the system for the benefit of the free market America to effectively, you know, grow my ball? This is the, you know, the great national economy. And their job is to A, make sure there's full employment, B, make sure inflation doesn't get out of whack. And when you think about that dual mandate, why did you have that inflation a component in the dual mandate? It's because everybody knows if you can print the money and pump it into the system, the Federal Reserve can, that you can pump in too much and you can create inflation. So the idea was keep everybody working, but don't overdo it. Let's not create so much money that we have rampant inflation. And right up until about 10 years ago, this was really the way the Federal Reserve operated. But the big problem today is with the Federal Treasury effectively $34 trillion in debt, there's a real need to coordinate the federal government's activities, its debt generation activities, with the people who print the money, and that's the Federal Reserve System. So we're starting to see this amalgamation or this coming together of what was supposed to be an independent banking industry serving an independent free market, centrally controlled by a federal government that is $34 trillion in debt. And that becomes a political problem, because when you try to separate politics from the economy, up until recently, that was just the norm. You know, nobody ever really compared the two. When you talk to Wall Street people, they're very much convinced that that, you know, politics is, you know, like sort of kind of moves the market, but it's not really important. What's much more important is the free national economy. We're starting to really start ask questions about that. And there's some really good indicators in the news today. There's an interesting story about how the Federal Reserve created, actually it was Congress that created this emergency lending facility run by the Federal Reserve during the SVB bank crisis last year, where bank reserves were coming under great strain because the Federal Reserve had jacked up the interest rates quickly, and it had a negative impact on the reserves of the banks. And that's why three banks basically failed, was that their reserves weren't sufficient. And that's when a bank goes south, it goes negative, when the reserves aren't in the right ratio range and the banks become insolvent. Well, the Federal Reserve put together this lending facility for banks. It was an emergency facility, basically giving them free money to adjust their reserves and prop themselves up. And it became very, very popular. And suddenly the banks realized that instead of making car loans and, you know, taking all this risk, you just go get free money from the Federal Reserve, who prints it all up, and then you can arbitrage that money in the marketplace. And I think that's one of the interesting stories as this facility is coming to an end in March. You know, it's going to put more strain on the system. Now, the numbers are very small in the scope of the giant banking system. And it's, you know, it's not going to be an earth-shaking event. But what it tells you is two things. Banks will always go to free money. And B, when these programs end, there's going to be a time of adjustment. I don't think it's going to be anything too big to worry about. But at the end of the day, it just goes to show how the banking system and the Federal Reserve System works in tandem with the federal government. And that wasn't the way it was designed back in 1913. So we'll sort of be watching that story to see what's going on. Another interesting story I wanted to mention briefly check my time here, is that I talked yesterday about the $1.66 trillion bipartisan deal that the House of Representatives cut with the bipartisan support in the Senate, and the president apparently has been to sign it. And of course, then I mentioned that the conservative faction is saying, no, no, we need to have some, you know, some spending cuts. And we need some fiscal discipline. And of course, this being an election year, and every member of the House of Representatives is reelected every 2 years. When you elect your congressperson, congressman, congresswoman, congressional representative, it's a 2-year term, and they go back to the district, and then they, you know, they tell everybody what a great job they're doing or whatever, and they get themselves reelected. So they're up for reelection. And of course, these very conservative members are elected from very conservative districts, and conservative people are watching in horror as the federal government continues to be $34 trillion in debt, and now $1.66 trillion seems to be a stopgap. The continuing resolutions, there are four of them that have to be voted on. It's $1.66 trillion. And of course, the folks back home are going, wow, that's a lot of money. What are you doing to stop this? So there has to be this show of fiscal prudence. And the fiscal prudence is turning out to be $16 billion. Now, $16 billion to you and I might be a lot of money. It would be a lot of money to me. But if you're a billionaire in America, if you're only worth $16 billion, you're kind of on the poor end of the billionaire club, because that's not a lot of money. I think what's Elon Musk in a $200 billion. So they're doing this symbolic thing, and there's going to be some ruffling of feathers, and they may hold things up a little bit, and we're going to shut down the government. And then, of course, this whole thing will pass. They'll go back to the districts and they'll say, I fought to cut, you know, the spending, and we got to bring fiscal. And then the conservatives will vote for them and send them back. It's kind of how the whole model works. But at the end of the day, I'm not expecting any real problems with the continuing resolutions, because I don't think anybody in Washington is going to shut down the federal government anytime soon. But what that does do, of course, is it goes back to our hypothesis, or at least our theory, that this is a very inflationary time. And that's why, as an individual, you will want to be thinking about protecting your assets from inflation. And that would require you to perhaps own real estate or gold or silver or collectibles or whatever. But you might want to be in this new year, if you're doing New Year's resolutions, sit down and make a list of your assets and sit down and make a list of your liabilities. And you want to be thinking about getting out of debt with respect to variable interest rate loans, because as inflation goes up, so does that interest rate. And at the same time, you want to own things, you know, when the rising tide of inflation comes and it's lifting your boat right along with everybody else. And really, that'd be a good time to call Swiss America, 1-800-519-6271. Ask them for that free information, or go to their website. Just go shopping around. You can get the free information. Use the promo code Eastman. But think about that, because you have to do something to protect yourself, because the government is no longer capable of collecting enough taxes to pay their bills, so we will be borrowing forever. And that's why when you see this, you know, $16 billion in cuts, you know, from that perspective, it's disheartening. So anyway, thanks for tuning in. Hope you appreciated the Federal Reserve lecture today, and we'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon. Bye.